And it's the News Roundup, where we discuss the region's top stories of the week. Joining us this week, Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And Laura Reckford, editor at the Barnstable Enterprise. Good morning, Laura.
Morning, Mindy.
Well, Governor Patrick announcing a shakeup in his administration. Yesterday, the governor announced nearly half of his cabinet is leaving, including embattled Health and Human Services Secretary Judy Ann Bigby and Public Safety Secretary Mary Beth Hefferman. And as Sarah Birnbaum reports, they're resigning under a cloud.
The governor hopes this announcement will put behind him some of the biggest controversies of his administration: evidence tampering at the Department of Public Health drug lab, a deadly meningitis outbreak linked to a state-regulated pharmacy in Framingham, and the hiring of Sheila Burgess, who had a terrible driving record, to the post of state highway safety chief. But at the press conference, Patrick denied Bigby and Heffernan's departure has to do with scandal.
There's always going to be news, some of it real, some of it concocted. There's always going to be news.
Patrick suggested problems at the drug lab and compounding pharmacy were almost inevitable.
There are going to be, in large organizations, things that go wrong.
As for the Sheila Burgess scandal,
it's an embarrassment. That's it.
The shakeup is somewhat routine. Patrick says when he was reelected in 2010, he asked cabinet members for a two-year commitment, and it's been 2 years.
I said that we would go through with everyone at the end of 2 years. We started that conversation in some of the cases well before some of the headlines that you're talking about.
Secretaries Bigby and Heffernan disappeared immediately after the governor spoke, even though they were supposed to stay around to answer questions. But Bigby's replacement, John Polonowicz, says he hopes to learn from past mistakes.
It's, taking the lessons from what has been found in the drug lab and ensuring that in any of the other areas that I'm responsible for, that we've taken a look at, the system and the processes, and we've addressed those.
Other cabinet members who are leaving include Budget Chief Jay Gonzalez and Secretary of Education Paul Revel. For WCAI, I'm Sarah Birnbaum on Beacon Hill.
Well, one of the things, it is not uncommon to have a change in your cabinet as you enter.
Yeah, in fact, I was trying to look through some notes here to find out, what the turnover sort of ratio is, administration to administration. Certainly this cloud of uncertainty and scandal, really, with the drug lab, of course, is sort of, I'm sure, at the forefront of most minds. But, I got to believe that the average citizen has never heard of these people, especially the people who are coming to replace. And, fortunately, I guess, for Governor Patrick, this happened after he was reelected. And so he sounded a little bit testy in those comments there. But I don't think that he's doing this with an eye towards worrying about reelection or something. So
it really feels like politics as usual. It goes around and around.
All right. Other news of the week. Town of Aquinnah joining the list in a federal lawsuit against the state's casino legislation.
That's right. This is the town of Aquinnah, of course, is where the Gayhead Wampanoag tribe is historically based, and they've been federally recognized really since the late 80s. It's a small town, of course. I think there's only 300 or so, maybe give or take a dozen or so folks. And so the selectmen, the three-member selectmen board, two of which, by the way, are Aquinnah Wampanoags, filed a motion in U.S. District Court to sort of be an intervener or someone else to be considered to have official standing in this lawsuit. The lawsuit itself is this lawsuit that KG Urban has filed. KG Urban is a developer that has strong interest in building a resort casino in New Bedford and have for some time. Their lawsuit alleges that the state's law that sets aside this one southeastern Massachusetts license for the Mashpee Wampanoag, they call it a race-based set-aside that violates the Equal Protection Clause. Actually, I think this is going to be an interesting case to look forward to because, of course, the whole notion, and it's been long established based on the 1988 Indian Gaming Act, is that any state that allows for gaming, an Indian tribe has the rights to establish an Indian casino. So, I can imagine, the argument saying, well, Congress passed this Indian Gaming Act for this express purpose, and we're simply, trying to be in accord with that. I suppose it's so. I guess I'd be fascinated to hear precisely what KG Urban is arguing in light of federal legislation.
Yeah, what legal ground they're trying
what
to
What legal
down.
Ground, right, yeah. Exactly.
So you'll be sitting in on that court case.
I don't know that I'll actually be able to sit through the court case, but I'll certainly follow it carefully. I know George Brendan, our reporter, who is really studious on this issue, will be there.
But
with the town of Aquinnah, there's also something interesting on that front, though, which is that I think the town of Aquinnah really wants to essentially hold what Aquinnah has said, at least over the years, that they wouldn't build a casino on the island. Although I think in the past year or two, with all of this casino craziness and this, you know, sort of Mashpee getting this license, but what about Aquinnah and them wanting to also open a casino? There, I think there had been some talk floated that, well, you know what, maybe we'll just try to do something on our reservation land in the town of Aquinnah. Now, the state, the governor's position and the state's position and the town's position has been that, look, when you guys got federally recognized, you signed away your sovereignty rights. I believe that was in 86, 87 or so. In fact, there was a land court case on the island when the tribe, it was over a small building,
a
shellfish hatchery shed or something. And there was a fight between the tribe and the town over whether or not the tribe had to go before the town to seek, you know, permits and permission to do it. The tribe then argued, in this case was, I think, in the late 90s or the early 2000s, the tribe argued, look, we don't have to ask for permission. It's on our land. We're a federally recognized tribe. The town argued, oh, no, you agreed to sign away those sovereignty rights. It went to land court, and the land court judge sided with the town and said, yes, in fact, you did. Now, the wrinkle here, though, is that the Aquinnah are saying that may be well and good when it applies to a shed at a shellfish hatchery, but when it comes to this federal legislation, not only does it trump local bylaws, but when we signed that document, supposedly signing away our sovereign rights, the Indian Gaming Act wasn't even established yet. And so they're saying we couldn't possibly be signing away a right that didn't yet exist.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, that's why this is so interesting. The Aquinnah situation, I think, is really the one to watch closely, because ever since this whole casino thing came up where it's now legal in Massachusetts, which the timing was almost perfect for the Mashpee tribe, the Aquinnah have always been saying all along, hey, what about us?
Right.
And they've been very interested. Now, you have the island of Martha's Vineyard that has its own commission, very tight on land use. And of course, you've got a lot of wealthy, powerful people who own property there. So I think this is one to really watch as the months go by.
Absolutely. Then we have the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. They're expected to vote on Tuesday on a proposal to accept applications from commercial bidders for that casino in the southeast section of the state.
That's right. Of course, as listeners are probably already familiar, this whole plan calls for three casinos in the state, one of which would be given first dibs or set aside for the Mashpee tribe, the other two being commercial owners, non-Indian entities. So the problem, of course, as we've talked about on this program, is that, well, first of all, the gaming compact that the Mashpee tribe negotiated with the state has been rejected by the BIA. The BIA essentially said, look, the tribe has given away too much to the state, and we can't approve that, especially because the BIA is supposed to be, you know, representing tribes or looking out for tribes' best interests. And they're saying, nope, you gave away the farm. We're not going to sign off on that deal. Then there's this whole complicated business about getting land into trust. We won't get into all of that, complicated stuff. And so the Massachusetts Gaming Commission and, you know, in Taunton, where the tribe has this agreement with the town of Taunton to build this casino, really, it sounds like the folks in that area, they really don't care who builds the casino.
They just want a casino.
And so I think there's some concern that as this whole legal wrangling plays itself out, it could take years, there's going to be lawsuits, and they're worried that given the economy, given the competitive market in and around New England with, you know, neighboring states putting up casinos, that southeastern Massachusetts, who really probably of all parts of the state wants a casino the most, they're worried about getting left in the dust and maybe being the last and maybe, worst case scenario, being at a point where the market is oversaturated or there's not really enough business, and then you're the last of the game, it's not a good operation. And so the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, I think, in acknowledging those concerns, have decided really to do this parallel process. So they're not putting a deadline on the Mashpee tribe, and they're also not saying we're not going to give you that license. But what they are saying is, let's do a parallel process
just in case,
plan B. So let's line up some folks. Let's do some sort of, investigatory background checks on some folks so that if at some point, possibly in about 6 months or so, if it looks like there's no movement on the tribe side, we can move forward with the commercial bidder.
Yeah.
The idea has even been floated that maybe the Mashpee tribe, even though they would probably hate to do this just as a matter of pride and principle, that maybe they ought to think about bidding on a commercial license, mm-hmm. particularly since you would imagine, you know, aside from all of the hurdles and the permitting and the legal stuff, they're probably really, you know, they probably are ready to put shovels in the ground yesterday. Mm-hmm. So they mm-hmm. certainly do have a plan in place. Now, the tribe hasn't commented specifically about the idea of them just saying, never mind the whole Indian process, let's just do the commercial bidding process. So right now, we're in a sort of a state of flux, and the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, and I think a lot of people, including some state reps in that area, who are for the casinos, are saying good for the commission to start this parallel process because we don't want to get left in the dust.
Well, again, I think it's getting very political where you have people in New Bedford really pushing to start this parallel process. If I'm part of the Mashpee leadership, I'm thinking, why do you need a plan B? We're here, we're ready, we're millions of dollars into this process already. So I think it does behoove them to participate in whatever other process is going on, because this process might become the process.
Right. And how ironic, you know, for a while there, it was like the Mashpee tribe was, you know, they're the ones that, you know, ready, giving them the head start. Everything looked like it was going along fine, although we've always had this question about the land into trust. And now all of a sudden, like, the brakes are...
Well, they had these deadlines to meet. They met them one by one. They were tight deadlines over the summer, if you recall.
Yeah,
we were all watching
yeah.
closely, and they made all these deadlines, and they got these positive votes, and they did all that. And then this surprise where the agreement between the state and the tribe blew up. Who would have ever predicted
right.
that? And,
exactly.
and by the way, no one applauded Deval Patrick for apparently getting a very good deal for the state, but the whole thing really became just an embarrassment.
Yeah.
And back to the drawing board on that, and that may have fatally delayed the whole process yeah. for the tribe.
Well, there's arguments for and against allowing dogs in Drummer Boy Park and Brewster were heard in court this week.
This is Drummer Boy Park. It's the 17-acre park on Route 6A. It's actually a really beautiful area. I've been there a few times mm-hmm. myself. You know, there's a small playground area. There's a gazebo. There's a huge grassy area, and the view is beautiful too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the background you see
and
the
a windmill
ocean. And a windmill. That's right. And dogs.
Yeah.
In fact,
there were,
exactly
yeah.
a lot of dogs. And so the Brewster Board of Health on March 20th actually passed a ban on the dogs, saying they were a threat to public health. And that led to some lawsuits, or a lawsuit. There was one particular Brewster homeowner, Jordan Spreckman. She's a or he, I'm not sure, man or woman, but is a wealth advisor from Manhattan. They own a dog, ironically named Brewster, and you know, would love to use that park. And Spreckman's attorney, Ben Zender, is basically arguing that the ban goes beyond what is necessary to ameliorate the health concern. In other words, they're essentially arguing, saying, listen, the Board of Health is supposed to be concerned with restaurants, you know, wells, water quality, you know, things that, you know, that we associate with things that directly affect our health. Something like dogs is under the purview of the selectmen. And in fact, the selectmen, the night before, I believe, the Board of Health passed this ban, had voted 3-2 to do sort of a King Solomon thing, which is let's share the park and let's split it and let's come up with times. Dog owners can use it before 10, I think, in the morning, after 4 p.m. So between 10 and 4, if you want to bring your children there or something, you know, you have the park there dog free. But the Board of Health outright banned it. Now, the Board of Health, of course, is arguing that dogs biting people and different thing is a threat to public safety.
Also, the excrement left behind.
The excrement left behind, and so that's what's being played out here in this case. And you know, frankly, it would be interesting to me to see how this plays out, because on some level, I get the point that the attorney is making about what the Board of Health's purview is. I mean, because under the threat of public health, I mean, it does raise the question of, well, does that mean the Board of Health can ban anything that they deem to be, you know, that could be a threat? I mean, you know, kids riding skateboards could be a threat. The list goes on and on. So I think there's some slippery slope concern here about the scope of a Board of Health's authority in something that they believe is an issue that should be determined by either the selectmen who are elected or at a town meeting, mm-hmm. You know, where it's a town-wide process. So this is going to be an interesting case, I think, actually, yeah. to watch.
Well, it's Cape Cod, so it all comes around to tourism. And when you think of Provincetown, is now considered one of the top places in the country to visit with your dog. And what we have on Cape Cod is actually a very dog-friendly mm-hmm. populace mm-hmm. here.
Right.
But again, you always have this controversy, particularly on beaches, and this is a park, but on beaches every year, when are dogs allowed to be there? People like their dogs to run free. Mm-hmm. And as a dog owner myself, I give a call out to all you dog owners out there, pick up after your pet, because this is what makes it terrible for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes that, and that's really what ruins it right. for everyone across the board.
And we'll have to wait. I guess the judge says he'll render a decision on the case at an unspecified time in the future, so we'll mm-hmm. hear what happens there. All right, FAA, Laura, gave some good news to the Barnstable Airport.
Well, that's right. The airport had wanted to do a giant solar photovoltaic installation on 30 acres of airport property, but it looked as though that wouldn't happen, mainly because a big solar array was put up at the airport in Manchester, New Hampshire, and worst case scenario, the air traffic controllers were getting blinded by the glare from the solar panels, so it looked like this was not going to happen.
That's a problem.
The
yeah.
FAA visited the airport officials yesterday and said that they had hired an expert to look into what happened at Manchester and realized that a mistake had been made in how the panels were set up. They feel they can fix that mistake, and now they have an entirely new set of guidelines for how to put these in. They are now in favor again of putting in solar panels, and they say that not only will the Barnstable Airport be able to do this project, but the FAA will probably help financially with this. Now, this 30-acre solar array, which would be just an enormous array, would zero out all the airport's electric bills, as you would expect. It would also generate about $6.5 million for the airport over the 20-year power purchase agreement that the airport would hold with the owners of the solar panels. That's the new way to do solar panel farms, if you can call them that, is to sort of have an agreement with someone who manages them, and the airport's looking into that as well. So that was good news. The other good news was the FAA said that it's very interested in making sure that there aren't buildings, privately owned buildings, commercial buildings, too close to the airport property. And they said that two buildings that are located nearby the airport, the FAA would be interested in giving the airport money to purchase those properties.
Hmm.
The airport is looking at that as an opportunity, ironically, for them to develop some property. They had wanted to develop the Mildred's property near the airport. Mildred's Chowder House was there for years, was torn down because it was considered too close to the airport. Now it's considered that part of the property is too close, but with these two additional parcels that the FAA says it will help purchase, the airport believes it can develop something. And like many people don't know that the airport owns the Cape Town Plaza, like that area of commercial development, the airport would lease out commercial buildings and get rent, and so it would be again more income generation for the airport, which has been suffering from a huge decrease in the number of plane trips out of the airport right. lately. So good news for the airport
exactly.
officials.
Well, we have a study conducted by Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies shows a declining water quality in Cape Cod Bay.
Right, which I'm sure no one's surprised about that. But the study itself is part of this 5-year monitoring program. And so, as you can imagine, they've been looking at water quality and salinity and dissolved oxygen and pH levels. And essentially what they found is that, you know, closer to shore where there's, you know, development and much more human activity, the water quality isn't as good as it is further out. And so, you know, I think this is just sort of yet another piece of evidence which folks on the Cape are very familiar with, and which is why we've been wrestling for years now with how are we going to afford this mm-hmm. estimated $3 to $8 billion to deal with wastewater, you know, through a combination of elements, whether it's sewering or you know, and other types of mitigation to clean up, you know, waterways. So it's an important problem, but it's one that's very well recognized. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I I don't think anybody's really surprised at this report. I think it's just, you know, sort of yet, you know, another piece of evidence of something that everybody's already convinced of.
It's really shocking when you, Buzzards Bay Coalition, I think, when they did a, they had a map that showed where the eelgrass was plentiful. I don't know if it was 20 years ago, 10 years, it's kind of gone through the time. And it is really shocking when you look at, you know, how much eelgrass there was even 20 years ago compared to what there is now.
Well, particularly when you think of Cape Cod Bay has such perfect flushing. And so when you know that even that is getting polluted, you know there's a problem.
Right. Then we have a rule that changes shipping lanes is set to expire. And there's some concern over what that may mean to the whales if this rule is altered.
So this is the speed limit, really, that was set. And, of course, it has a sunset provision in it, essentially. So it's set to expire on December 9th of 2013. So right now, there's some, you know, various environmental groups led by the environmental charity Whale and Dolphin Conservation, WDC, who are really trying to gin up in, a public campaign and support, really, to pressure regulators and government officials to reestablish the speed limits, which have worked to cut down on the number of ship strikes of these right whales. There's only about 500 or so of them in the world, which is sadly, the numbers are up a tiny bit since they, you know, I think they had dropped to as low as 300 maybe 10 years or so ago. So these are one of several measures that try to protect these, you know, these marvelous creatures of the sea. And of course, there, you know, in the shipping industry, there are groups and there's interest in sort of relaxing the rules a bit, saying, you know, their basic argument is like, listen, we know what the migratory patterns of these right whales are. So when they're not sort of doing their migration thing, you know, why be so strict on the speed limit? And so, you know, I like the quote that actually we had in the paper from a whaling museum educator, who said something to the effect of, you know, when there's flexibility like this, it always seems like, the whales get the short end of the stick.
Well, it's interesting, too, that is that we know what the migratory patterns are. Do we? We have, 25 whales spotted now? And,
They're early.
Right.
Which
and
is
Stormy Mayo said this is the earliest that they've seen them. So, you know, that's debatable, I would say.
And this is so interesting about the right whales, because as Sean said, there were only considered to be only 300 only a few years ago. And so in a way, they've actually really rebounded. And in fact, when they were at 300, people thought they might be at the point of no return, that we were really seeing the end of it. So to have 200 more, it's a successful program. And so the regulators look at that and say, we have to keep on with that.
Well, what happens when a shipwreck that happened in 1804 is discovered teetering on what is now the dividing line between federal and state water? This is an interesting case.
It is interesting, and I suppose it can get complicated, but to keep it simple, I think the thing that makes it very interesting is it's a world that almost no one has any experience in. Of course, Barry Clifford, treasure hunter Barry Clifford, folks are probably familiar with him through his exploits with the Whydah, that pirate ship, in his museums. Barry Clifford, actually, this was the Semiramis. This is this 120-foot schooner that actually was returning from this 2-year voyage from New England to South America, and apparently it has gold, silver, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of gold and silver, and some Chinese porcelain. So this wreck apparently was found by Barry Clifford and John F. Kennedy Jr. actually when they were diving together. I think it was in the late 70s, maybe. I forget the exact year. Maybe I'm off. I guess it was discovered in 1978 or so.
But the question is, who gets it?
Who gets it? Yeah. And the reason why it's an interesting process. And so apparently, a part of the ship lies in state-controlled waters, which I think goes out to 3 miles or something off the coast, and a part of it is in federal waters. The reason why it makes a difference is because any wreckage that's in state waters, the state gets 25% essentially of the value of that. You're basically a tax of 25%. In federal waters, ironically, you hear all this talk about regulations on the federal level, but on the federal level, the regulatory process of claiming these ships apparently is a lot easier. Yeah. In the state, there's all of these permits that you need and the money. And so Barry Clifford is basically saying, look,
I'll give you the 25%.
I'm going to give you the 25%. That's not a problem. I'd like to keep good relations with the state board that oversees this and everything. So what's the problem here?
Yeah. So I guess we'll see what happens there.
Well, particularly Clifford is interested in putting a, perhaps a pirate museum in the old armory in Hyannis, right in the center of Hyannis. So, you know, this would be more display for that museum if that happens.
Yeah. Passenger rail service coming to Cape Cod, at least for the summer months.
Yay! Well, you know, transportation officials, of course, this is something they've been talking about for a few years. And in essentially what it is they call it the Cape Flyer. It'll be a weekender train service that will have five trips from Friday through Sunday night. There'll be, you know, a couple at the beginning of the week towards the Cape, a couple on Saturday and Sunday heading up to Boston. They're also trying to figure out the round trip ticket. I should mention is $30. I think it's $34 round trip ticket to go by bus. Wendy Northcross, the head of the Chamber of Commerce on Cape Cod, thinks that the trip will last about 2 hours. And good news, according to their survey, because they did a survey of folks who said, if we had a weekend service, what kind of service would you, what kind of amenity would you like to have on the train? Well, this train is going to have Wi-Fi, but the number one survey,
what?
A bar. So they're going to have a bar on there so people can throw back some drinks.
Well, hopefully this will cut down on a little bit of our summer traffic. Wouldn't that be nice?
Hopefully. Although, you know, You know, the whole notion of if you build it, they will come. We don't necessarily know that that will be the case. But there is a campaign, a marketing campaign to market this to folks in Boston. And, you know, any little bit, I suppose, helps. And it gives us an opportunity for folks to come to the Cape and actually use the third bridge that everybody would love to see. Exactly.
Well, it would be fabulous. Of course, you get concerned when you find out the number one thing they want is a bar, because are people going to be staggering off this train? And then what happens? They stagger into the middle of Hyannis. And then what do we do with them? So it all has to be figured out still.
Laura, the ballot question that voters approved to make medical marijuana legal in Massachusetts might have some people wondering, where do you buy it?
Well, it's interesting. The town of Barnstable is in the forefront here of getting in starting to talk about a bylaw that would put the medical marijuana places in certain parts of town, and several other communities across the Commonwealth are doing this as well. And when I first heard that they were doing this, I thought, oh, well, it will probably be in the industrial park where you put the sort of undesirable things like strip clubs. But no, they want to put it because it's medical marijuana. So right near Cape Cod Hospital, basically the center of Hyannis. But conveniently, it's where police spend most of their time anyway. So that is where they're targeting for the medical marijuana. In the meantime, some councilors would like them to put a ban on medical marijuana dispensaries for the time being until the State Department of Public Health figures out all the rules and regulations. But Fred Charagotis, the town council, former town council president, had the idea of putting this bylaw into place so that the town would be grandfathered should the dispensaries come to be.
All right, so we'll have more to come on that. Laura Reckford, editor at the Barnstable Enterprise, Sean Gonzalez, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Thank you both.
All
Thanks,
right,
Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.